Wait a second, I got my foot caught in my purse.
Oh, that's okay, I'll get that for you.
My name is Eileen, and I'm an alcoholic.
Eileen.
And I'm really glad to be here, and I want to thank the committee, and particularly Lisa, who stayed in contact with me this last few months and came and got me at the airport, and I got off the plane, and she told me I'd know what she looked like, and I did. And I liked her immediately. I'm very fond of the hair geographic. I take lots of hair geographics because it's cheaper than moving. And I'm going to move this. It's very distracting. There are candies and things in there. I'm just going to get it out of the way. I used to be a young person in AA, and then I got old. But I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975 when I was 24 years old. And back in 1975, there were not a lot of young people in AA. There were not a lot of attractive young people like we see in AA now. I was one of the more unattractive of the unattractive young people. And much of that had to do with my appearance. I weighed 230 pounds of attractive bloat. I was wearing a $5.99 granny dress from one of our better discount department stores called Zodi's, a pair of Zoris. I had a bad haircut and a worse attitude. And I was not a vision for you, is what I'm trying to say. And and 22 and a half years later, my life has really changed. So I am here to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I was born 46 years ago in Boise, Idaho. That's an unusual place to be born anyway, but my parents happened to be Jewish people from the Bronx. And they weren't just passing through, they actually lived there for 10 years. And when I was 4 years old, we all moved to California. And when you're four, you're not given any choice, and I don't remember Idaho anyway. And anyhow, we all moved to California, and I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, where Valley girls come from, except that I left the San Fernando Valley before girls started talking like that. And I don't know what it is, but it seems like teenage girls everywhere seem to talk like that. But anyhow, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and you know, I wasn't the kind of kid that you would look at and say, oh, she's going to go bad someday. I mean, I was literally the undisputed star of my grammar school. I'm one of those people who sort of peaked at 11 and a half, and it was downhill from there. But I was the star of my grammar school. I was the head of everything, the teacher's pet, the principal's pet, the nurse's pet. You know, the head of the safeties, the student council, the cashier in the cafeteria. That was a very good job. And I was the mistress of ceremonies at my grade school graduation, where I got to do square dance calls in phonetic Portuguese, which I'm sure none of you got to do. And but by the same token, I was also like a really weird kid and a really self-obsessed kid and a very self-conscious kid. And I walked around all the time wondering how I was impacting the planet. That was very important to me. You know, it was very important that I would impact the planet in some way, you know, and that all of you would notice. And you know, I was kind of like a dog. You know how dogs are, especially like Labrador retrievers? You know, they're very pathetic and desperate dogs, you know. And they're always coming at you and going, how am I doing now? How am I doing now? Am I okay? Am I okay? Huh? Am I okay? And then they leave for like 5 minutes, and then they're like back, and they're like, how am I doing now? How am I doing now? I sort of always preferred cats. You know, cats are sort of like this. You know what I mean? I mean, they don't really care. And eventually what happened to me is I became a dog in cat's clothing. You know what I'm saying? I really cared, but I walked around like this all the time. And I was just a really screwed up kid. I was a very neurotic kid. I had a lot of nervous problems. You know, I never felt like I fit in, you know, everything. A friend of mine used to describe it perfectly. She felt like she was jettisoned to Earth without the brochure. You know what I mean? It's like everybody else seemed to know what they were doing. I didn't know what I was doing, ever. I mean, I never knew how people were supposed to act or what they were supposed to do. And it's not like I didn't have role models. I grew up in a nice family. You know, I grew up in a family where my parents are still married. They're married 53 years. They have to stay together. They're a set. Their names are Harry and Harriet. I mean, you know. Anyhow, you know, and I didn't grow up where I was beaten. There wasn't any drinking in my immediate family. There's alcoholism in my family, but not in the family that I grew up in. I'm fond of saying that if there was anything dysfunctional about my family, it was me. And I was the one who created all the chaos in my family. And I started creating chaos pretty early. I skipped half of the sixth grade. That's what they did with gifted children in those days. I was considered to be gifted. And they didn't do me any favor, because then I went into junior high school with a bunch of people I didn't know. And all of a sudden, I'm in a strange place with a bunch of people I don't know. I am no longer the biggest fish in a small pond. I am now a small fish in a big pond. And it really pissed me off. And when I was about 12 years old, I was babysitting, and this guy that I knew brought some beer over. And that's, for me, how life began. I'm one of those people who immediately discovered what alcohol is for. I didn't waste time, you know, being sociable at cocktail parties with martinis. You know what I'm saying? I immediately discovered what alcohol is for. It's for getting drunk. There's no other reason to drink alcohol as far as I'm concerned, okay? That's the only reason why anybody should drink alcohol. I love social drinkers, you know, the ones who lean on the bar and go, "Oh no, no more for me. I'm beginning to feel it." To which you respond, "That's what you drink for, you dumb son of a bitch." Anyway, I always drank for what it did for me. I'm a cheap wine drinker, okay? I am a cheap wino, and I love cheap wine. I drank the kind of wine, as my friend Don N. says, you know, it's the kind of wine that sort of, you know, hovers over a grape without ever coming in for a landing, you know what I mean? In California, we have wonderful wine like Ripple and Thunderbird and Red Mountain, and I was particularly pleased one time when I was in college. My friend Len and I went to the store. We discovered something that was called red wine. It was plain label before there was plain label. It was just called red wine. I think it was about $1.29 a gallon, and that's my kind of wine. You know what I'm saying? It's just incredible stuff. And I grew up during the 60s. I took a lot of drugs. I make no apology for the fact that I took drugs. That's what we did, you know. You know, the drug controversy has been raging in Alcoholics Anonymous forever. I mean, I remember when I was new, the controversy was this. The people from the drug rehab, the local drug rehab called Cry Help, were coming over in the van to this meeting in Hollywood called Gramercy, and they were eating all the cookies and not putting anything in the basket. So that pissed everybody off. So as soon as they stopped eating all the cookies and started cleaning up the meeting, nobody gave a shit that the drug addicts were in the meeting. So, I mean, you know, eventually, I gotta tell you, and you guys know it, and it really is the truth, eventually the demographic in Alcoholics Anonymous is gonna change to the point where there won't be anybody here who didn't use drugs because of the times. And that's just how it is. Pure alcoholic, not pure. I'm a wino who loves to take drugs. That's what I am. I like to drink wine, take medication intended for sleep, and sit in the corner and drool. That's what I like to do. And if I'm not doing that, I'm driving my car. Watch out, you know. And in California, there's a lot of canyon roads that go from the valley into the city of Los Angeles, and they're curvy, and I like those the best. So I apologize if you probably, none of you were in those roads, but where I live, people were. Anyhow, I'm one of those people that the book describes. Whenever I drank, I was more or less insanely drunk, because that's what I like to be. I mean, there are some people, there's basically two kinds of people, I think, who come to AA, the ones who drink to get into life and the ones who drink to get out of life. And I drank to get out of life, and I don't know what it was that was so bad that I wanted to be out of it all the time, but I just wanted to be out of it. I hated myself. I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. You know, in California, if you want to fit in, you got to be thin and tan and blonde, and let's face it, I'm not, you know. And everything always pained me. I mean, they sometimes say, and I don't know if this is true or not, that for alcoholics, you know, colors are brighter and sounds are louder, and everything pained me, and I had to drink so that nothing would pain me, because I discovered when I was about 14 years old, looking back in retrospect, that I had made a decision that whatever it was that was good or decent or worth having in life, I was never going to have it, so why don't I just hang it up? You know, and it's not like I didn't see examples in my family of people living normal lives and doing normal things, but I knew that was never going to be my lot in life. I mean, I knew by the time I was 14 years old that I was a piece of crap and that nothing was ever going to happen to me that was decent in any way, so I just thought I might as well just give up now. I mean, I remember when my high school prom rolled around, and, you know, of course nobody asked me to the prom because I was a slut and a skag, and nobody asked me to the prom. And I remember thinking, God, you know, I'd really like to go to the prom, but, you know, I'm not the kind of girl that people ask to the prom. So the night of the prom, I got loaded, and I made fun of everybody who went to the prom. And, you know, and I wanted to be one of those girls in a long dress. I was way past the point, you know. And when I was 5 years sober, I had a friend named Richard Arthen, and I can mention his name because he's dead. He died of AIDS, not alcoholism. And, you know, he was my first friend to die of AIDS. I've lost lots of friends to AIDS, drug addicts and gay people, you know, and in Alcoholics Anonymous and not in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I remember I was 5 years sober, and he called me up one day and he said, get over here, I've got your birthday present. And what he had bought me was one of those giant cymbidium orchid plants, and he said to me, this is your corsage because you never went to the prom, you know. And you know, I used to have a friend who used to say that, you know, some people get to AA, they're so cool, they're frozen, you know. And the last 22 and a half years for me has been a process of thawing out, you know. It's been a process of me admitting that, yeah, I want the kind of life I saw in my family, not the life that my disease of alcoholism created for me and, in fact, forced me to live. You know, and anyway, I drank and used for a total of 12 years, 12 years only. I do not have a big spectacular story. I have a pathetic little story, which is what most people in Alcoholics Anonymous have. You know, AA is a wonderful place. You know, it's a place where people like to play a game I call, can you bottom this? You know, I mean, AA is the only place I know of on the planet where you can get a lot of prestige out of having been in 47 nut houses and 22 jails. You know, I mean, you know, out there, I mean, like, you try that material at the high school reunion and they back off. But, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they really get impressed by that. I mean, I remember my first year, I thought, I got to go out and shoot some heroin and prove my story, you know, because it was the only thing that I'd never done. And what I didn't realize and what most of us don't realize is by the time we get to the doors of AA, our stories don't need any improvement. You know, my story didn't need any improvement, but I didn't know that because the longer I drank and used, the more peripheral my existence became and the less and less I understood that I was just living on the fringes of society, drinking and using like a pig and not even understanding at all what was happening to me, because the disease of alcoholism is a disease of hopelessness and helplessness. And even if you at one time had really high standards in your life, which I think I did as a kid, you just keep lowering them and lowering them and lowering them so that you can continue to drink and use with what you think is impunity, even though you're really not getting away with anything. But I thought that I was just having fun. I was having fun. It was the 60s. It was free love. It was, I mean, you know, none of that's ever free. But I mean, you know, it's like, it was insane. It was insane. And, you know, I just didn't, you know, I got to the point where, you know, in my mid to late teens, I didn't ever let anything affect me anymore. You know, nothing ever got to me anymore. And I just went along and lived the way that I was living. And, I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the summer of 1974. I was 23 years old. Like I said, there were not a lot of young people in AA. I had no idea what an alcoholic was. I had no idea if I was an alcoholic. You know, because I didn't know. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous before. I had seen it on late night TV. There was a public service announcement about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that I drank too much. I always knew that I drank too much, and who cares? You know, that's what I do. Yeah, I drink too much. That's what I do. But I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I didn't know that once I started to drink, I couldn't predict my behavior after that first drink. I could never predict my behavior after the first drink, but generally, I went in the direction of whoever had more, okay? You know, and when you're young, I mean, it's hard to get, so you do things, you know, in order to make it possible for you to continue to drink. And when you're a girl, it's not that hard. But anyway, I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1974, and I got an impression of Alcoholics Anonymous that I hold to this day. I looked at AA and I thought AA is good, it's decent, it's wholesome, it's unhip. People seem to be nice to one another here. And it was the first place that I had been to in years that I thought, if I could let down enough of my guard to let you know that I wanted what you have, instead of the crap that I was coming from, it was the first place in years that I felt that nobody would laugh at me. See, because I always thought if I admitted that I wanted what I saw in my own family and in the people that surrounded me, that people would just laugh at me and say, "You? Who are you kidding? Not you, you know." And I stuck around for 5 months, and I never refer to that period of time as slipping. It was not slipping. I was drunk for 5 months, and occasionally I wasn't drunk, like for a day, maybe 2 days. I didn't get a big book. I didn't get a sponsor. I leaned against walls in meetings and with my arms folded, and I glared at people, and I dared them to come near me, and most of them didn't. You know, there were a couple of really mean guys in Hollywood AA, and they liked me. And they used to talk to me, and they wouldn't take no for an answer. But I couldn't let anybody near me. I heard a woman describe how I came to AA perfectly. She said, "I came to AA like this. Help me! You know, stay as far away from me as possible, but please help me." You know, this morning in the sponsorship panel, and I'm sorry I had to leave early, I had to meet somebody in my room. But Annette was talking about how hard it was for her to ask for help and how hard it was to ask somebody to be her sponsor because she didn't feel like she was worthy to have anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous help me. I felt the same way. I felt the same way. I was so wounded and so hostile and so frightened by the time I came to AA, I couldn't ask anybody to help me. When the holidays rolled around in 1974, the Christmas holidays, I thought to myself, "You're not sober anyway. What is the point of sticking around this outfit?" And I left. And my vague plan was to come back right after the first of the year. My anniversary is March 3rd, so it took a little longer than I anticipated. And when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came back for two reasons. I came back because I was tired, really tired. And I came back because of the perception that I got of it in 1974. I knew there was something else here that I had never encountered, that I had never tried, but that it was something that might help somebody like me. And the second day that I was here, the man who became my first sponsor backed me up against the wall of a meeting hall in North Hollywood, California, and he'd seen me around in 1974. And he said to me, "Look, punk." He said, "You have a serious problem with alcohol and drugs, and you better goddamn well get sober, or you're gonna die." And he backed it up by saying, "And if you don't get sober, I'm going to break your jaw." Now, I don't know what you would have thought. I thought, "He cares." And then I wanted to know why. Because some people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they're able to immediately accept the love of the group. And they really want to be here. And they feel like they're home. And everything seems to be like, "Oh God, I've been waiting for this my entire life." By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was like, if somebody did something nice for you, it's because they wanted something. And if you did something nice for somebody, it's because you wanted something. And I knew instinctively that I had nothing to offer. And of course, what I found out later is the reason why this person was nice to me is because 13 years earlier, somebody had been nice to him when he made it as impossible for people to be nice to him as I was making it for people to be nice to me. I took his phone number, which I think is miraculous. That we actually take phone numbers of people we have never met before in our lives and we pick up the telephone and we call them. Do you know what a miracle that is? Not only do we call them, but sometimes we actually start telling them things about ourselves that we swore we would never tell another human being in our lives. And almost instantaneously, because they say that Alcoholics Anonymous is based on the principle of one drunk talking to another. I was in shitloads of therapy before I got here, trying to find out what was wrong with me. I even had a therapist that I smoked pot with. I got very enlightened during those sessions. But, and I'm not here to knock therapy. I have actually made use of therapy since I've been here. And if you have a problem with that statement, go to your big book and page 133 in the family afterward. It's the only page I can quote, by the way. But there are many physicians and practitioners working in their field. But I will tell you the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing that I have ever employed as treatment for my alcoholism. Therapy I have used for other things that I have had to deal with since I've been sober that nobody in AA should or could have been expected to help me deal with, and that's the difference. My program has never been therapy. My program has been the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I was in therapy before I got here, They couldn't help me for four basic fundamental reasons. Number one, I didn't trust the therapist, so I always lied to them. And it's hard to get help when you're lying. Number two, I always had the feeling they didn't understand what I was talking about, which may or may not have been true. Number three, I always felt that it was my obligation to entertain the therapist, even though I was paying them. And I'm really good at that, by the way. And number four, and most importantly, looking back in retrospect, I think what they were trying to do was get me happy enough to stop killing myself. At 22 and a half years, I'm still not the perkiest person I've ever met, okay? The only problem with that approach is with chronic depressives and malcontents like me, generally the patient dies before they ever get happy enough. Alcoholics Anonymous takes the opposite approach. That's the genius of AA. AA says, stop killing yourself first. We'll worry about the reasons later. The incredible thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that you don't have to know anything about why you drank in order to stop drinking. The way you stop drinking is you stop drinking. I will repeat that for the rocket scientists in the room, such as myself. The way you stop drinking is you stop drinking, and then you work the steps to get down to the causes and conditions so that you can stay stopped. So that you can stay stopped, and so that you can continue on this road of sobriety. Anyway, I called this guy. What an incredible thing. But what was even more incredible is after the first time I called him again, because what made it so incredible for me to call him the second time is that the first time I called him, completely unsolicited by me, he started telling me what to do. Now, I don't know about you, I don't like people to tell me what to do. I just don't like it. But he started telling me what to do. He told me that I had to go to 7 to 9 meetings a week. I had to sit in the front row. I had to be responsible for my chair and my ashtray. I had to get a big book. I had to thank speakers, whether I thought they had anything to say or not. He told me that I was essentially useless, but I had a car. And I could drive other people to meetings. Now, I didn't like any of this. Not any of it. Because when you drink and take a lot of downers, you're not used to taking a lot of action. You're used to taking a lot of unscheduled naps, but you're not used to taking a lot of action. And particularly I was not used to taking any action on my behalf. I had thrown myself away years before. And so the thought of taking any action on my behalf was so startling to me. But I started doing what he told me to do. Because I was so desperate to not live the way that I was living, and because I was afraid of him. And I'm glad that I was afraid of him. And not only that, but I am so grateful that nobody who dealt with me when I was new was the least bit interested in my opinion about the direction they were giving me. See? Because it wasn't really their business if I got sober or not. They could only share what they had done to stay sober, which is all we can do here. We can't make anybody stay sober. We can't force anybody to stay sober. But if somebody wants my help, I'd sort of like them to try and do some of the things that I've done. Because, you know, you don't get Alcoholics Anonymous by osmosis. Or by, you know, doing the kind of thing. I mean, if Alcoholics Anonymous were an intellectual pursuit, and I'm a pretty smart girl, if AA were an intellectual pursuit, I could have read that book, been out of here in a couple of weeks. You know what I'm saying? But Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work that way. Alcoholics Anonymous is a series of actions that you take over and over and over and over again. You know? You take them over and over again. I mean, for instance, I've never felt that the point of AA was to get yours and split, which a lot of my peers have done. The point of AA is to get yours and give it back to somebody else. That is the point of Alcoholics Anonymous, to stay sober and carry the message. That is the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I started getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to meetings every single day. My first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous was shaking hands at the door of a meeting called Wilshire Normandy. They called it that because it was on the corner of Wilshire and Normandy. There are some geniuses in AA. And it was at that time the biggest meeting in Los Angeles. It was a really large meeting. You know how sometimes, I mean, I'm sure there's some sort of large meetings around here, and people are always telling those stories about how they go to this meeting and there's 800,000 people in the meeting and they all come at the newcomer, you know, with their teeth bare, shirt, little pieces of paper, you know, with their phone numbers on them and shit. And then after they've been sober for a while, they realize there was only like 20 people in the room. Well, Wilshire Normandy was as big as I thought it was. And God, I mean, it was a wild meeting. We had a streaker there one night. Every once in a while, they get a transsexual to speak, which was really interesting. And I mean, it was just, and everybody went there. That was the perfect mix. Everybody went there. Young, old, black, white, rich, poor, men, women, gay, straight. Everybody went to that meeting on Sunday night. Seemed like everybody in AA went there. And I was a greeter. And I still hadn't gotten over my initial hostility, so I was a hostile greeter. In other words, if you came to Wilshire, you got greeted whether you wanted to be or not. And I wore some strange get-ups. People still remember me from those days. And people just left me alone, and they just let me do that. And I came to AA with no life, which I think is a really good way to come to AA, because then you have nothing to do but go to meetings. And so I would get to Wilshire about an hour and a half early, because I had a particular place where I liked to stand in the doorway, and I used to put my keys down on the floor to hold the place, and God help you if you stood there, because it was my place. And what I didn't know is that I was taking my place in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was making Alcoholics Anonymous a safe place for me. Anyway, I finally called this guy after about a month, and I said to him, are you my sponsor or what? And he said, I guess I am. And then he spent the next 5 years trying to get rid of me. He never wanted to sponsor me because he didn't want to sponsor women. And I understand that. I don't really like to sponsor guys because I've never been one. But he became like the first person in AA I trusted. And how did I trust him? I walked up to him one night in a meeting. I got about an inch from his face and I said, I don't trust you, you son of a bitch. And he looked back at me and he said, people in AA are so tolerant. And he looked back at me and he said, why not? And I said, I had a dream that you betrayed me. I was paranoid. And he looked back at me and he said, you must trust me. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you're telling me this. And I thought, oh God, you know. Anyway, I had a succession of sponsors after that, and finally 14 and a half years ago I asked my current sponsor to be my sponsor. One of my past sponsors, Sam, is in the room and helped me through an incredibly difficult time in my sobriety, and still my great friend. But Julie became my sponsor 14 and a half years ago. I call her the Great White Goddess because she, as her son says, she is no ordinary white woman. She's very white and she has white hair and huge blue eyes, and she's so 35 years, and the reason why Julie is my sponsor is because she has what I want. She's still an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, she still goes to meetings. She still helps people. She still sets up the meetings and breaks down the meetings, and she's an honest and forthright person. She tells the truth about who she is. You know, about 3 years ago, she moved up to this little mountain town. I was there last weekend to visit her. She lives about an hour and 20 minutes outside of L.A. now. And every time I go up there on a weekend, we go to the Saturday night meeting. If we're lucky, there's 10 people at the meeting. Generally, three of us are from out of town. And she talks about when she moved up to that town, and they have a women's stag on Wednesday night. And she said the first time she went, there were four women. The meeting was an hour and a half, and they went over. And she's gotten herself involved in the life of that town, and she sponsors a couple of the women there, but I'm her favorite. And she tells me that too. I'm her favorite, and that makes me really happy. Anyway, she's my sponsor, and you know, if I just want to like whine, I generally call my friends, but for the important stuff I call her. And I like knowing that she's in my corner. You know, I like, and she's the one person I'll listen to. I mean, if she tells me something, I do it, and I don't waste her time. And it's not because she's God, it's just because I trust her. And I trust her with my life. I love her so much. And I like the bond. You know, they were talking this morning in the sponsorship panel about consistency and about, you know, the AA, you know, for lack of a better word, hierarchy. You know, my sponsor, me, the people I sponsor, the people they sponsor, the feeling of continuity. My home group is called the Sunday Morning Robertson Originals. I'll be missing it because I'm in Ohio, and the reason why I love my home group is because I have 22 and a half years, and there are consistently 25 or 30 people in that meeting with more time than me, most of whom saw me come into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we got a guy that's going to have his 50th birthday, you know, next January, and Sam came, you know, this January. He got sober in L.A., and he came this January and spoke for his birthday, and he has 40 years, you know, and it's like, I mean, the continuity of all of that, and having been in Alcoholics Anonymous consistently, never taking a hiatus from Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've never stopped. You know, the women in AA taught me how to work the steps, and the steps have become the fabric of my life. I mean, that's really what it is. I hate that question, what step are you working? You know, because at any time I could be working, you know, some or all. I mean, you know, I'm always working the first step. I know that. I believe most of the time I'm working the third step, certainly the second step, because I haven't had a drink in 22 and a half years. But it's like what happens with the steps for me, or what has happened with the steps for me, is that there's a thing in acting or singing called the subtext. And what that is once you've learned the words and music of a song or the words of a play or something, the meaning underneath it is what's called the subtext. And I believe that once you learn how to work the steps, your life becomes the subtext. And it's almost like you instinctively know how to handle situations which used to baffle you, and you instinctively know which step to work. For instance, I work in show business. It's a business where people are not traditionally always nice to one another. Now, I know you find this hard to believe. Occasionally, I'm shitty to somebody on the telephone. But unlike most of the people that I work with, if I'm that way, I know immediately I've got to call that person back. So I call him back and I go, "This is Eileen. I am really sorry. I had no right to talk to you that way." Now, I don't have to say to them, "Look, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm working the 10th step. Says that when I'm wrong, I have to promptly admit it, because if I don't do that eventually, I might get drunk." Now, the truth of the matter is, that's all very true. If I don't do it often enough, I might get drunk. You know, and so, you know, it's sort of like you're prompted to do what it is that you need to do. And if you don't know what to do, you can call your sponsor and they can tell you, you know, what it is that you need to do. You know, it's like, I need all the help I can get. You know what I'm saying? I mean, when I got here, I was resentful of the amount of assistance that I seemed to need to get through a day. Now I'm kind of like, bring it on, you know? Back in 1987, I was in Israel. I was working there. My then employer's brother came over, and we were having a discussion one night at dinner, and Todd happened to be a Christian. And we were talking, and Todd said to me, "You know, people say to me all the time, Todd, Jesus is a crutch." And he says, "As far as I'm concerned, if Jesus is a crutch, let him be a stretcher. I'll just lay down and let him carry me." Now, I'm Jewish, so I don't feel quite the same way about Jesus as Todd does. It's sort of the basic fundamental difference between our religions. But I feel that way about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, people are always saying, AA is a crutch. AA is a crutch. Do you still have to go to those meetings, you know? I mean, what? Yeah, I do. Hello. I go to 3 or 4 meetings a week. 5, 6, 7 meetings a week if I'm in trouble. And I go to meetings for 4 basic fundamental reasons. Number one, I go to meetings because I need them. I have never been the kind of person who's ever been able to labor under the illusion that I don't need AA. Okay? I am a real human being with real human problems and difficulties. I don't know how I would live on the planet if I didn't have AA to go to. And that's really the truth. And more to the point, I don't know how I could live in Los Angeles, you know, with what we've been through in the last 5 years. I mean, we've had riots, earthquakes, floods, fires. I mean, you know, anything that could possibly happen to a city has happened to our city. But AA in Southern California is very powerful. And so I go to meetings because I need them, because I get a lot out of meetings, and because I'm able to put a lot into meetings. I like knowing. You know, in the 12 step, in the 12 and 12, they talk about that sometimes, you know, 12 step work is just putting your ass in the chair in a meeting so that people can see that you're there and that it still works. I like knowing that people like seeing me come into a meeting. If nothing else, I'm an example that Alcoholics Anonymous works. So I go to meetings because I need them. I go to meetings because I like them. I like Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and in Los Angeles, we have 2,400 meetings a week in the greater Los Angeles area. So, you know, I always love when people come to me and say, I can't find a meeting I like. So I give them our meeting directory. It looks like a small novel. And I tell them to go to every single meeting in the directory and then come back and tell me that they can't find a meeting they like. I figured it out. The simple mathematics is if they go to a meeting every single day, it will take them 7 years, okay? So not only do they go to meetings, you get rid of them. And actually, Sam gave me a meeting directory from 1966, and there were only about 300 meetings a week then, so AA's really grown. And I was looking through it because I was trying to find, like, some interesting meeting names. My personal favorite? The No Donut Group in Pomona. I just figured that these are a bunch of serious people sitting around going, we don't want our meeting adulterated by pastry, you know, and maybe even no coffee, you know. We just don't want any refreshments to detract from the message. I'm glad they had food in the meetings that I went to, because when I was new, I was poor. And sometimes I ate at meetings. Sometimes my food for the day was the cookies that I could get at meetings. And that's really the truth. Anyway, I go to meetings. The third reason why I go is because, as my sponsor Julie C. says, that's where they keep the newcomers. Not being in the habit of going to bars anymore, I find mine in the meetings. And, you know, and as I said, the point of AA is not to split. The point of AA is to give it back to somebody else. And how are you going to give it back if you're not going to meetings? And number four, and most compellingly, the reason why I go to meetings is because I need to go to remember that the only reason why I look the way I look today, feel the way I feel, have the life I have, the car I have, the apartment I have, the job I have, the friends I have, the relationships I have, the higher power I have, and most importantly, the sobriety I have, is because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for no other reason. So I need to go to meetings to continue to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and the message of hope, the thing that keeps me coming back. Anyway, I have had a blast in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had some really awful times too, but basically overall, I'd say I've had a blast. You know, I used to think when I got here that, man, they had taken away my freedom, you know? They had taken away my freedom. What I didn't know is that I couldn't leave a 6-block radius because I couldn't get away from the liquor store or the connection. I didn't have any freedom. I never went anywhere. I never did anything. I just drank and used. I'm one of those people who either drinks or has a life, but I don't do both. You know, and I think that one of the things that, you know, one of the things that earmarks young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm glad that I'm speaking at a young people's thing, is because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I saw all these, like, old people, you know, like I am today, you know, who seem to have gotten here having accumulated all of the trappings of normal life. I mean, before they even came to AA, they got wives and husbands and ducks and boats and cars and college degrees and careers and, you know, and I believed them, and they told these incredible stories, and they accumulated all this shit while drinking, and I believe that they did that too. What I don't understand is how they did it, because I don't function when I drink. I mean, I function at the most marginal, you know, existence possible. I have a part-time job, or I pretend to go to college, you know. I mean, it's like, I don't think so. I used to try to go to college. I went to college for 4 years. I accumulated 35 units, you know, and a lot of the time I had every intention of going to class, but then Freaky Dave would, intercept me with his briefcase full of drugs, and that was the end of that day. Anyhow, Freaky Dave and Heavy Don, those were two guys I knew in college. Heavy Don is dead of a drug overdose, and I don't know where Freaky Dave is. Anyhow, you know, I had to grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to learn everything that I know how to do today in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I always love when I go to meetings and they have this thing up on the podium, you know, no profane or vulgar language, you know, and I don't really even swear anymore. It's just because I've reacquainted myself with the English language, but when they do that, it just makes me want to do it more. You know what I'm saying? I'm just one of those people. I spoke at this big roundup in Sacramento, California, and they had this cake in the back of the room for the anniversaries. It was like the size of a football field. And they had a sign by the cake. It said something like, don't molest the cake, something like that. Well, you know, I wanted to fling myself on top of the cake. I really wanted to molest the cake. Anyhow, Anyhow, the words that were filthy when I got here were words like job, responsibility, commitment. I didn't want to do any of that stuff. But I learned how to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that a commitment was not that you got the cookies and threw them at the meeting and then went to the movies. I mean, that's not a commitment. A commitment is you get the cookies and you stay for the meeting. A commitment is that you get there early to set up the chairs, and a commitment is that you stay late to tear down the chairs. The whole purpose of all that shit is so that you will talk to people here. I didn't want to talk to anybody because I didn't know how to talk. I believe it was, Ron in the back of the room, I guess it was Chuck, but he talked about when he got here, he just didn't know how to do anything without being loaded. Man, I didn't know how to do anything without being loaded. I had to learn everything from the ground up, I had to learn everything from the ground up. And I've become pretty successful in life. And you know what? That's not even what AA is about. AA is about staying sober and trying to become successful as a human being. And I believe that I've done that as well. I believe that the steps have turned me into a totally different human being. They used to say that you cannot think yourself into right action, but you can act yourself into right thinking. Now, I am by nature a miserable malcontent and a negative son of a bitch. I mean, that's what I am by nature. I am not a perky individual. But actually, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I become a fairly positive person. I mean, it astonishes me. But I've had the kind of spiritual awakening that they talk about in the back of the book. I have had a complete change of attitude that has been brought about by taking the actions in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I used to think I wasn't a very spiritual person because I'm not the best prayer or meditator I've ever seen. And you know what? AA is not a competition sport. But I'm a good spiritual activist. And what a spiritual activist is somebody that tries to get out there and help other people. I'm really good. My 11th step is irrevocably enmeshed with my 12th step. I mean, because where I see God is when the light comes on in somebody else's eyes. And the two spiritual leaders that I have admired most in my life are the Dalai Lama of Tibet and Mother Teresa, who just died. And the reason why I admire them is because they are spiritual activists, because they were really out there, Mother Teresa in particular, who really tried to help other people for fun and for free. I mean, that's why she did it, because that's how she got spiritual sustenance. I believe that. And that's what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you are not helping other people, I would encourage you to start now. People always say, well, I don't know enough to help anybody. Well, it's like if we all waited to get an A in AA before we helped anybody, we'd all be dead. It's like we're all amateurs here. We're one drunk talking to another. Nobody knows more than anybody here. Nobody here is a guru, even if they tell you they are. You know what I'm saying? Nobody is. The last thing I want to have is an image in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor used to say, if you're worried about having an image in AA, look around the room and see exactly who it is that you are trying to impress. Think about it. I am here to tell you the truth about who I am in the hope that I can help somebody else. See, because not only do I need to desperately identify with who you were before you got here, I need to identify with who you are in here, because I have gone through lots of experience in life. I knew that Sam had been through bouts of depression in his sobriety, and when I hit my murderous black hole depression when I was 7 years sober, I went to Sam, and Sam helped me more than anybody because he knew what I was talking about. He wasn't some amateur metaphysician who said, you can choose to feel any way you want to in 20 minutes, I mean, it's like, people always say things in AA because they don't know enough to just keep their mouth shut if they don't have any, experience. And so in helping other people, the only times I've ever had to make amends to people that I've tried to assist is when I've tried to give them advice about things I know nothing about. Advice is crap. What we're here to share is our experience, strength, and hope, which means we've had an experience. We make it through to the other side clean and sober. We have something to share with somebody else. I always love the people who say, don't get involved in your first year. I mean, you think about that. They're usually people with somebody at home in their bed. Have you ever noticed that? I got involved in my first month. It was great, It was a diversion. It kept me from drinking. Never mind that the guy that I picked went to the Denver International Convention with another guy I knew, got drunk and stole a car. It doesn't matter. We went to meetings together, and we drove people around together, and got swore at by people, together. And, it was like we were together in that pursuit. And he has never been able to stay sober. He's around as long as me. I don't know how much time he has now, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I used to have a friend named Donald Madden, who's also dead, and he used to say, if anything can get you drunk, anything can get you drunk, you know? I had a Datsun 510 automobile in my first year. It developed some incredibly bizarre electrical problems. This car used to drive me so fucking insane. I remember one time, I mean, it was doing it again. I, like, pulled up in front of my house. I threw myself on my front lawn and had a tantrum. Now, that car really made me more insane than any human being I've ever been involved with. So what do you tell people not to drive? I mean, you know, it's like, let's be prepared for anything here. Let's have experience here. Let's find out what works and what doesn't here. Because the truth of the matter is, if you stick close to the program and your sponsor, and you remember your primary purpose, which is to stay sober and carry the message, no harm can come to you. You know, I mean, they talk all the time, you know, in the book about the loners and the people who are, I mean, I have met loners, people who stay sober on, you know, tapes and books and the phone calls of others, you know, and that's how it is for some people, and they actually stay sober. I'm glad that I don't have to stay sober that way. I'm glad that I live in a place where the fellowship is big and enthusiastic, but you know what? I believe that I could stay sober anywhere if I remember the principles. When I was about 10 years sober, I started to travel. Now, I think the only reason on earth to have money is to travel and get a lot of massages, okay? I particularly think it's good to have body work in other countries. And anyway, I have, since 10 years, I've been to Paris and I've been to Italy and I went to Jamaica. I mean, people said to me, how can you, I love reggae music, and people said to me, how can you go to Jamaica and not smoke dope? I said, excuse me, how can I live in Los Angeles and not smoke dope? You know, I was relaxed in Jamaica. I have the pictures to prove it. You know, and I've been, you know, to Hawaii twice and all over this country and Canada and, you know, but by far the most interesting trip I took was to the Middle East. I went to the Middle East to Israel for 6 weeks in 1987. Now, in Israel, the meetings I got were we had a women's stag on Wednesday. If we were lucky, we had four. I went to visit some very bizarre loners out on the West Bank whose politics I didn't agree with. And I went to NA meetings in a bomb shelter in Tel Aviv. Now, everybody in Israel practically speaks English except for the junkies, because where you learn it is in high school or the army, and they don't go. So their meetings are in Hebrew. So one night I gave a talk. It was translated from English into Hebrew by a native German-speaking girl. I have no idea what they heard. I'm the only person who goes to Israel. The first people I meet are a German girl and her Japanese boyfriend, Dido, who turned out to be a masseur, of course. Anyway, about 3 years after I came back from Israel, I get a call one morning. It's at 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning, you know, a time that all of you sincere people I know love to get a call, but I'm not fond of it. But I pick up the phone, and it's this guy, and he says to me, this is Arnel. I met you in Israel. I'm in Spring Valley, New York. Do you know where there's an NA meeting? I mean, I don't even know where Spring Valley, New York is. And if I had been at the top of my form, I would have said, oh, I've got that directory right here in the bedside table. But anyway, I didn't know. And so I said, I'll try and help you. He spoke very little English. But I had an experience that morning that I hope some of you have someday. I called Central Office of Narcotics Anonymous in New York City. Okay? Guy answers the phone. He goes, hi, I'm Jewy, I'm an addict. And I think, ah, shut up, who isn't, you know? And anyhow, I told him about Avman in Spring Valley, and I said, could you maybe help him? And, you know, I never heard anything after that. But while I was in Israel, I met a girl named Nancy, and how I met Nancy is right before I went to Israel, I had a crisis whose name I can't currently remember, so if you're having that kind of crisis, it'll pass. But anyway, my sponsor, I think, was doing a play in Arizona, so I called my first sponsor, who I hadn't talked to in about 3 years, and he started to laugh, and he said, of course you called me. I have to give you Nancy and Bob W.'s number in Tel Aviv. I said, who are they? He said, oh, there's some people I met in Hawaii, but they now live in Israel. They're in the program. So when I got to Israel, I called Nancy. I was in Jerusalem, and she was in Tel Aviv, which is about 45 miles away. And I called her up, and I told her who I was, and she said, I know who you are. And I said, how do you know who I am? And she said, a month ago, somebody from the States that I didn't know sent me a bunch of AA tapes, and one of them was yours. Anyway, she saved my butt while I was in Israel. I mean, because I was not getting along with my then employer. Life in Israel was not as I was used to. The meetings were not what I was used to. I mean, it got so bad in Israel, I actually tortured a couple of women by making them write inventories and read them to me. I mean, that's how bad it got there. Anyway, Nancy really, really helped me. And after I came back to the States, she and Bob divorced, and she moved to Santa Monica, California, which is essentially Los Angeles. And then she remarried, and she went back to Israel, and she went to the NA meeting in the bomb shelter, and there was Avner of the phone call, and he was clean, so maybe I helped him. Anyway, while I was in Israel, I went to Egypt. Why? Because you can. And I got on a plane, and I flew to Egypt. Now, you understand, I am more used to crawling around on the floor, but now I'm in Egypt. And I'm riding a camel, and I'm taking a cruise on the Nile, and I'm shopping, and I'm buying, and I'm carrying on, and I'm going in the pyramids, and I'm touching the Sphinx, and I mean, you know, and I'm there for 2 days, riding around in an unair-conditioned Fiat. And Egypt is really a country where you feel loaded even when you're not, because it's so hot, and so exotic, and so filthy, and so overcrowded, and so fabulous. I mean, you really feel loaded. And at the end of the second day, I am dead from this excursion I've been on, and I am reclining in the Papyrus Palace, not to be confused with, no, the Perfume Palace, not to be confused with the Papyrus Palace, but in Giza, where the big pyramids and the Sphinx are. I mean, this is really pretty good. And I'm reclining there, I'm 12 and a half years sober, a guy I have never seen before in my life walks up to me and he says, "I can get you some hashish." My immediate reaction is, "I'm in Egypt, who would know?" And I thought to myself, you had better get your ass back to that bomb shelter, even if you don't understand anything they're saying, because the disease never sleeps. Never. Okay? Anyway, my life has been my life. My life has been my life, and what I want to tell you about my life and what I understand about God is that God has a huge infinite mind. I have a puny finite mind. And when I'm in the middle of an experience, I don't understand what the mind of God is, so I don't try to interpret anymore. You know, I used to be in a lot of interpretation of God's will. My first experience with interpretation of God's will was when I was about 6 months sober. I was bored with being in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that none of you have ever experienced this being young, but I was bored. I was bored with being sober. I was bored with being in AA. I was just bored. And one of my old friends, now I want to tell you about my old friends. I have one friend left from before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because she was my only non-alcoholic friend. But one of my old friends had managed to track me down even though I had moved and invited me to a party, which I decided I wanted to go to because I was bored. So I went to the young people's meeting on Saturday night. I didn't tell anybody what I was planning, of course, because somebody in the meeting might try to stop me. I was driving home to change my clothes to go to the party, and I started interpreting God's will. And I decided that I would call my sponsor. And if he was home, I wouldn't go to the party. But if he wasn't home, it was God's will, and I would go to the party. So I got home, it was 10:30 Saturday night. I thought, oh, there's no way he'll be home. I called him, he was home. He told me something I have never forgotten in my life. He said to me, "You can go to the party if you want to, but if you get loaded, don't fucking bother to call me." And I thought, I think I'll watch TV. Anyway, if you think that life somehow, as I thought at one point, that eventually I would get to the point where everything would be in a nice, neat little package, think again. God has a way of throwing what I call celestial monkey wrenches into the mix. And a year ago July, I got a whopper of a celestial monkey wrench. Part of the wreckage of my past is that when I was 18 years old, I had a child, a son, that I gave up for adoption. And he was 3 days old, and I signed him away, and I never considered keeping him, because I knew. I mean, well, back in the 60s, too, if you were like a middle-class white girl, you weren't really given the option of keeping your child. But even if I had been, I knew that I was in no position to raise this child. I mean, I knew. I was an 18-year-old practicing alcoholic, so I gave him up for adoption. I signed the papers, and I have to be honest with you. I've never been someone who had a lot of longing about all of this. I have since met other birth mothers who really are filled with so much longing about, you know, where the child is and what's happening with the child. I went and made inquiry about him one time when I was 30 years old and he was 12. I went and made inquiry about him for the one and only time, and I got a baby picture of him. And I found out that he was adopted, and I found out that he knew he was adopted. They'll only give you non-identifying information. And I thought about him on his birthday. His birthday's exactly a week after mine. And, you know, I didn't, you know, really do much of anything about it. And I had made the decision years and years ago based on talking to people on all sides of what they call the adoption triangle. The birth parents, the kids who are adopted, and the people who have adopted children, that I was not going to search because I felt that it was an invasion of his privacy and that of the people who adopted him. So I never thought that I would meet him. I didn't really think that I would meet him anyway. A year ago, July 4th, I'm sitting on my couch. It's 9:30 in the morning. I'm drinking coffee, staring out the window, thinking how great it is that I don't have to go to work for 4 days, thinking eventually I'll get off my butt and go to the store and buy the ingredients for the salad that I said I'd take to the party later in the day. And my telephone rang, and it was a woman, and her name was Julie Jones, and she said, "I'm a private search and investigator from Seattle, Washington, and I've been asked to locate you," and I had no idea why she was calling. And I thought, oh, I wonder which one of my friends in Washington has gotten themselves into trouble, because I have some friends in Washington. And then she said, "Is your name Eileen Waterstone?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "Does the date March 28, 1969 mean anything to you?" And then I knew, because that was his birth date, and I burst into tears. And I said, "Is he in Seattle?" And she said, "Oh, no, he's in your area code." Well, my son was living 1 mile away from me 27 years later. Anyway, I became an instant parent of a 27-year-old son. She said to me, "Can I give him your telephone number?" I said, "No." I said, "Give me his, call him back, tell him I'm really glad, tell him I'll call him when I've collected myself." And I got off the phone, I called my sponsor who was home, thank God. I called my parents who weren't home, thank God. They're getting closer to meeting him now, though. It's only taken them a year and a half. Anyhow, I called a couple of friends, close friends of mine who have adopted children and got their blessing to go ahead. I called a couple of more friends. I said a prayer. I picked up the phone. I said, "My name is Eileen Waterstone, and I understand you're looking for me," because I had said that I would be open to the possibility if he were to call me. And in our first conversation, he told me he'd been in a drug rehab for cocaine 2 years earlier. So I thought, well, I might as well tell him I've been in AA for 21 years. And I thought about it later, because he was drinking and using at the time, and I thought about it later, and I thought, he's probably sitting on the other end of the phone going, "Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Oh, God, she knows. Oh, shit." Anyway, I met him 2 days later. I took him downtown for sushi. He thought that was incredibly genetic, because it's his favorite food, too. He looks exactly like me, except that he's 6'3" and half Mexican, and a guy, he's gorgeous. He's so beautiful. I went on and on about him one day for so long, my friend Kale said to me, "Eileen, he's your son." I said, "I know." Anyway, he wasn't sober for a long time after we met, but I had told him that I would have a relationship with him regardless, and I started going to Al-Anon. I mean, it was so bad, I started going to Al-Anon. Now I'm sort of sponsored on the internet by my friend Mary Pearl T, who some of you might know. She doesn't know she's sponsoring me, but, you know, that's my Al-Anon sponsor, otherwise known as my evil twin. Anyhow, it's been interesting. I didn't like him very much at first, because he was a practicing alcoholic, and he was a big, tall pain in the ass, really. And you know, but I've hung in with him, and I've hung in with him, and I've hung in with him, and in March he started going to some meetings, and he wasn't doing it the way I thought he should, but I stayed out of it. And he got loaded. And he got loaded. And then about 3.5 months ago, I invited him to come hear me speak. And he came and heard me speak, and I don't think anything I said in the talk, but afterward we went out, and I took him out to eat, and I brought him back, and we were sitting in the car, and he's a real motor mouth. And he's talking about this and talking about that and talking about this and talking about that. And he had gotten loaded because he got resentful towards some people that didn't call him back. So he was like drinking beer and going to one meeting a week, which, you know, doesn't really work. And we sat in the car and I said, "Aaron," I said, "if you give me your permission," I said, "I'll tell you what I think." And he said, "Okay." And I said, "I think really if you stop drinking those beers and start going to more than one meeting a week and stop going to that jerk-off place where you're going to meetings and start going to some meetings like this one and start calling some guys like the ones I introduced you to tonight, perhaps your life will change." Now, I'd like to think that I was responsible for him getting sober, but I don't think I was. I think the gorgeous blonde that he got the telephone number of that night was really the angel who interceded on his behalf, because she told him he should start going to the meetings that I wanted him to go to. And she introduced him to a guy that I like very much, who's become his sponsor. And so now he has 3.5 months of sobriety, and so not only am I a former young people in AA, but I'm the mother of a young person in AA. And you know what? The thing that I am the most grateful for out of all of this, the thing that I am the most grateful for, you know, in this particular experience, because I'm not his mother. His parents are his mother. They've been very generous to me. You know, they've met me twice and invited me to their home. I mean, they've been really generous with me, and I know that they're his parents. But I'm his ally. And the thing that I'm the most grateful for is who he found at the other end of the phone when he finally made the call. You see, because this scenario could have been very different if it hadn't been for Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, think of who he could have found, you know? Or not at all. I could have been dead by now. But instead, I'm very much alive and well. And everybody he mentions to, you know, he says, "Hey, Eileen's my mom." Everybody goes, "Oh, she's great. She's great. We all like her, you know?" And the truth of the matter is, I believe that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous love me for the right reasons, if they do in fact love me. And I don't think everybody loves me. But the people who do love me for the right reasons. They love me because I'm an honest, forthright, steady member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've always been willing to show up and try to be of help. And that's a reason to love people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and because I'm a drunk. I'm a drunk like everybody else in the room, you know, but I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and I have a wonderful life today, you know, and it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know this to be true, and if you're new, I would certainly invite you to stay. If you're young, I would invite you to stay, because the truth of the matter is, if I hadn't gotten sober in 22 years, I'd still be 46, and you know, I mean, so, you know, thank God that the last 22 years have been spent here with you, learning how to live, and man, I live, and so I'm really glad to have had the opportunity to be here, and I really want to thank you all very much for allowing me to share.